Hey, what's good? This is Rich.
And I'm Marcus.
And you're listening to Paychecks and Balances, where we talk making money, saving money, and getting out of debt, all while having some fun along the way.
Yes, sir. And as we've noted the past couple of weeks, our first course, Debt-Free, a four-week starter kit, is in development, under construction for my MySpace millennials, I guess, out there. Is that still millennials? It's still around. Yeah, it's still around. I don't think people use it. I'm going to take that back just in case MySpace wants to sponsor us in the future. Subscribe to paybal.co/email to get first dibs on the exclusive launch date.
Yes, paybal.co/email. And on today's show, we're chatting with Chris Browning of Popcorn Finance, aka Deep Voice Finance. And you'll see what I mean when we get going with the conversation. Beyond his story of getting out of debt, we talk about how he got started in podcasting, man things, and a lot more. So here's our chat with Chris, and we hope you enjoy. Chris, welcome to the show, man.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a good time. We were talking beforehand. We know each other. We've had some laughs. We've had some jokes. There's a lot of things that we know, but also a lot of things that we don't know about each other. And I think we'll get into some of that today. So tell the good people of the PNB family a little bit about yourself.
So I host a podcast called Popcorn Finance, and it really just came out of the fact that I really like talking about personal finance, and I always wanted to be like a financial advisor, financial planner. That was my goal coming out of school, but I graduated right in the middle of the recession. It was great timing, so there were no jobs for me. So I needed to find a new game plan, and ended up becoming an accountant, doing like some payroll work, doing different bookkeeping type work, and it was very boring. Not something that I was enjoying or passionate about at all, but I paid the bills, which was the important thing at the time. But I always had this passion to kind of, you know, talk about finance and teach and love podcasts. So that ended up becoming a thing after I sat around, had an idea to do a show for about 3 years, never did anything with it. Finally got the courage because some friends and my wife pushed me to go ahead and actually do something. And I started the show, and it's kind of been going from there. And it's been a lot of fun, especially because I get to meet great people. And that's how I got to meet you two through the show, which I was a fan of your show before I even met you. So that was a cool experience getting to know you guys. And, you know, I've had Marcus on the show, and you'll be up soon, Rich.
Appreciate it, man. I was wondering about that episode. I was like, oh, he think he better than me, huh? He ain't going to publish that talk.
You know, you gotta, when you have good stuff like that, you got to wait for the perfect timing, you know?
I appreciate that. And we did not pay you to say it.
I didn't want to cut you off, but as I continue to expand the brand, and maybe y'all could relate to this, I'm in that awkward place where more and more coworkers are listening to the show. So they might be listening to this show. So I have to say, whoa, 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 accountants? No, it's the funnest profession of all. Shout out to my CPAs and CIAs out there. So, all right, I'm done.
That was a great job lying about how great accounting is.
Hey, man, kind of, you know, it's a good paying job. You know, it's a lot of security. There's things to do. I mean, there's some things you could check out the box, but yeah, it's boring.
Where does the interest in finance come from? Was that part of the experience for you growing up?
You know, not at all. You know, growing up, we never talked about money at home. That wasn't a conversation that my parents cared to have with us. They were like, you guys are kids. Don't ask us questions. Be in our business. But we'll pay the bills. So just worry about going to school. So I never got any of that information growing up. And I actually went to college as an art major. I love Pixar. I wanted to work for Pixar. That was my dream in school. And I got into an art academy program when I was in high school, really enjoyed it, but I didn't know if that's what's going to be my career or not. But when I got into college, I needed to pick a major, didn't really know exactly what I wanted to do. So I picked art. I got there, and those classes are hard. And it was stuff that I did not enjoy doing. I prefer working on a computer. This is a bunch of like hand drawing and modeling with random toothpicks. And it was just some random projects. And I was like, this is not for me. These other people seem to really enjoy this. And it's not really hitting me. I'm not really feeling like this is what I want to do. And just by chance, one of my general elective classes I was taking was a personal finance class. It just happened to fit in one of those slots. And I was like, oh, this seems interesting. And I really enjoyed it. And I was like, this seems really interesting. I think I could do this. I think this is something I want to pursue more. And that semester was my second semester in college. I went and changed my major to finance and kind of just you know, took all the classes, started to learn more, get more and more interested. And I ended up selecting the financial planning track, or like the concentration within the finance major. And that's kind of how I got kind of interested in personal finance.
So I have a question, which I may very soon regret asking. You said two things here to make me feel more senior than the senior millennial that I am. What year did you graduate college?
So I graduated in, I think my last semester was in 2009.
I knew I was going to regret that question. All right. back to you, Rich.
So you start work, you're in finance, you've moved away from the dream of art because school corrupted you. So are you still in that space now?
So I currently work as an analyst. That's my day job. I'm a financial analyst. I do like revenue projections. That's kind of like my day job that still pays the bills.
Got you. And as far as the podcast goes, and we'll talk more about that, but you produce a ton of content. I've told you this before. I probably told you that I hate you because of it. You always got content on the social. You post it on the gram. You post it on Facebook. You put out multiple episodes. So I'm curious, you got a day job like the rest of us. How do you do it, man?
You know, sometimes I'm like, I probably need to slow down because I probably need a little more balance in my life. But really, it's just I go to work during the day, and then sometimes on my lunch break, I'll do a little bit of work, or sometimes I'll schedule something after work. But primarily, I do a lot of the work on the weekends because I used to do it like all throughout the week, but I was getting super burnt out. So I was like, okay, I kind of have to separate. I have to, like, two different worlds I live in. So it's like my day job life, and then when I get home or when I get to the weekend, that's when I switch over and start doing the podcast stuff.
And the show that you actually started, is that the show that you had in mind when you first had the idea 3 years ago? And then I'm also going to be curious about what held you back from starting the show. But was this the initial idea you had and you just sat on it all this time?
Yeah, you know, it's changed over the about like almost 2 years now that I've been doing it. It's changed a little bit. But yeah, this is pretty much what initially, it was going to be more of a solo show where it was going to be me kind of teaching people stuff and really diving deep into all these different topics. Then I realized that takes a lot of time and I don't have enough hours in the day to do the amount of research that I want to do to make these episodes what I wanted them to be. So I kind of morphed it and it kind of blended into being like a show where I'd also bring on guests because I was like, well, they could be the expert. They can do the research. They already got the info. I'll talk to them and they can teach me. And then every now and then I'll hop in and do my own thing when I have a little free time.
When did you realize that you had a good thing going with the show? Because I know we all get started. We're like, are people listening? I don't know. I don't like my voice. When did you start to say, you know what? I really got something good going here.
That's a good question. I'm trying to think when that would have been. You know, I think it was when I attended the first kind of finance podcasting blogging conference I went to. I met you guys a little bit before that, but you know, I think it was going to this conference called FinCon and talking to people about the idea and kind of getting some positive feedback. Because before, you know, when you do a show, podcast is not the easiest thing to get feedback on because, you know, you're recording it, it goes out, and then maybe somebody might send you a message to kind of say they liked an episode. But a lot of times you're just sending it out there and hoping that somebody listened to it. And so being in a place where there's a bunch of people who can give you feedback live on the spot, and when I would tell them about the show, the reaction was positive. And so that kind of helped me think, okay, maybe this is something I can continue. Maybe I'm not wasting my time and I can kind of put some more effort into this.
And you mentioned that it took 3 years for you to finally launch it. So what was holding you back? Was it just, and you mentioned the time aspect of it, but what else was going on? Because I know we all got those things that are going on in our head. So what was that for you?
Oh, it was definitely fear. It was definitely fear. I had the idea, kind of, I knew I wanted to do a podcast, and I even came up with a name and got the Twitter handle and all that stuff set up. And then I kind of just sat there and I was like, well, what if nobody likes this? Or what if nobody listens to this? And is this even going to be good? Well, you know, all these doubts kind of creep into your mind. And so I just literally for 3 years just kind of would every now and then think about it. And then say, no, this is not a good idea. And then I'm going to just go back about, you know, my normal day job and say, you know, whatever. And I just did that over and over. Just a lot of self-doubt and kind of just, you know, you don't know. You don't know what's going to happen. And it's something so personal. You know, it's your voice. It's your thoughts and your ideas. And the last thing you want is for someone to say, this was horrible and not listen to it.
That reminds me of that. So it's like we can get all this positive feedback, but then we get that 1 3-star review or that 1-star review. Or personally, what I hate, the people who leave 1 star and don't say anything. It's just straight 1 star. And it's like, say something then. And they don't. And Did you have that worry about getting that one piece of negative feedback? Like, especially once you got going and, you know, you produced a few episodes, or did you pretty quickly move to the, you know what? What I'm doing is dope. I'm dope. I don't really care about it.
You know, you're right. When you get that one piece of negative feedback, it just negates every positive thing that you ever heard. You know, you may have heard 50 great things, and then one person you don't even know comes in and says, you're stupid. you're just like, oh man, what am I doing with my life? Maybe this was a huge mistake. And I've had that happen several times where, you know, you're going along, you got some momentum going, you think things are going well, and then someone just says something. It could just be even something like, you know, I didn't really care for it. And you're just like, man, that hurt. That was horrible. So I kind of go back and forth. But I think now I've gotten to a point where I've done it so long that you kind of get it's a little bit easier to shrug off something. And I'd say the majority of the stuff I've gotten has been positive. A lot of feedback I've gotten back is positive. But, you know, every now and then you see something, but you get in a routine and you kind of learn to lean on, you know, okay, let me look back at this one positive thing someone said, and it kind of helps reassure you and keep it going.
And you may have answered my question there for the people. I think that's a story that a lot of people can relate to. I actually talked to a lot of people that have that exact story. The comment that I made, I think a few shows ago now is, and you can probably relate to this too, and, you know, just either interviewing guests or if you do mentorship and things like that. So I'm trying to help these individuals whom I know have the talent. I literally see it in them. They are capable today. But I've kind of noticed it takes that person to see it in themselves about 12 to 36 months, really along the timeline that you talked about. But do you have any actionable tips for someone to break outside of themselves that allowed you to break through that wall? Because I'm sure there are some people, wherever they may be sitting, car, podcast, show, a house, a home, cubicle, or officle, they can break out of that. Like, they're just, the only thing in their way is themselves.
Yeah, you know, I think there's probably, a couple of things that helped me. One was, you know, keeping the pieces of positive feedback I got and kind of holding on to that. So a couple of times what I would do is if I got like a nice review or a nice email from someone, I would copy it and paste it in like my notes app on my phone. And then, you know, every now and then, if it's like, you know, oh, man, this is getting rough, I go back and look at it. It's like, okay, you know, that helps. It gives you a little bit of motivation, a little positive reinforcement. It's like, okay, you know, someone is liking this. This is, you know, something that someone's enjoying, and it kind of helps you, you know, kind of keep going and push through those tough days. Because we all have those days where you're just like, I don't want to do this anymore, or is this worth it? You kind of, you know, you doubt yourself. That was one thing that I did. And the other thing was, I think, making it part of my routine and being consistent. So I think when you continue working, and sometimes I probably, you know, maybe do too much and probably need to take a little bit of a break. But when I continue to work and say, okay, I'm going to make this part of my weekly routine of continuing to record and interview and listen to other things and learn and grow, I think that habit and that practice kind of keeps you busy, and it keeps your mind going and keeps you in what it is that you're enjoying. So whether, you know, whatever it is that you're doing, if you are, I guess, kind of like put yourself in that world and make that part of what you do, it's just like a continual kind of like self-motivation as you go through, you try things, you put stuff out, or you create something, or whatever it may be. That process, I think, keeps you motivated and keeps you focused and keeps the, I guess, momentum going, and doesn't allow you to kind of fall off or have those moments where you're just kind of sitting there kind of doubting yourself, because you're like, oh, you know what, let me just keep going. I got this new project I'm going to work on. And it just kind of, that momentum just keeps building when you do that.
That consistency is so key, man. I always talk about that because I think as we see now, and Mark has mentioned it, it really takes years. And I think a lot of people, when they start a show or they start a blog, they expect that within a few months, the dough is going to be rolling in. They're chasing sponsors right out the gate. But really, you've got to be ready to commit to this for years if you want to see it ultimately get to where you want to get to. And maybe for some folks, they don't have some grand vision for it. It's just a passion. It's just something that they want to do for fun. And that's totally fine. But if you want it to get to a place where you're reaching the most people and you're accomplishing some of the things you're starting to accomplish now, and I know you're getting sponsors on board, you know, it takes a long time. So how long have you been podcasting at this point?
So with this show, it's 2 years, end of June for me. And back in 2009, I worked and produced on a podcast that a friend of mine did. It's a video game show. I'm sure no one listened to that.
I didn't even know what a podcast was then.
I know, it was, man, no one knew what a podcast was back then. We were telling people, and they're like, I don't even know what that is. How do you get that? How much does it cost? You know, no one knew what that was. So but that was my first time, and we probably did that for like maybe a year and a half on that one. But that was just more so pure fun. We had no expectations on that at all.
And so we'll talk about your debt story in a bit, but a few more questions on the podcast in front. And I think we could both agree by interviewing people, we learn a lot that we ultimately start implementing in our own lives and pretty much right alongside our audience. So what are some of the things that you've implemented or looked into from some of the guests that you've had on the podcast and now they're a part of your life or something that you think about regularly?
Oh, man, that's a good question. Let me think here. There's been quite a few people who have said some things that have kind of hit me and kind of like really stuck with me. I think one topic in general that kind of came up a lot was the whole financial independence, retire early movement, the whole FIRE movement. Mm-hmm. And that for me has been like a game changer. And, you know, I'm not full on FIRE. I don't claim to be one of the people who's going to be able to retire the next couple of years. It's probably not going to happen. But I think hearing their stories and how motivated these people are to save and then also kind of cut back in their life to, you know, live a more manageable lifestyle and not spend all their money. I've definitely incorporated a lot of that. And for sure, it's caused me to increase my savings. So before I was one of those, you know, 10% savings sounds pretty decent, you know, maybe a little bit more. But then I see these people are saving like 60% of their income. And I'm like, well, maybe I could do a little bit more. And, you know, I'm definitely not saving 60% of my income, but it's forced me to kind of up what I've done. So it's definitely made saving more of a priority in my life. And something that made me really think about, you know, how am I spending my money and what are needs and what are really just wants and what are things that I can hold off on? And, you know, what it would be better for me just to save and kind of think about this. Maybe I don't really want it. You know, it's I really like that the FIRE movement causes you to think critically about your own finances and make these changes, whether they're small or big, that can make these huge impacts later on down the road. So for sure, anyone I've talked to about financial independence has really, you know, stuck with me and, you know, something I think about all the time.
And because it is one of our top posts, I'll quickly hop in. Y'all know I like the hashtag plug. So that's paychecksandbalances.com/fire. And y'all can read our breakdown on financial independence and get our free 15-minute money tool. Back to you, Rich.
Yo, Mark is really sounding like the voice that cuts in and before the break.
If I could talk fast, I'd do the little, you know, disclosure voice. But, you know, it is what it is. The Lord giveth and taketh.
And another thing I've heard you talk about a lot more recently is tiny homes. How'd you get interested in that? Do you have one yet? I know you're having guests on who have tiny homes. I know you've been in a tiny home. How did this even come about?
You know, I'm trying to think how this first hit me. I don't know if it was like, it was probably like HGTV or something like that. I don't know where I first saw one of these tiny homes. I lived in a place that was tiny. It was not, I guess, considered a tiny home. If you looked at it, it was just a small studio that was not really designed well, but it was probably about like maybe 350 square feet. And I did not enjoy that at all. But when I saw these tiny homes, I was like, oh, these things are designed really well. And it kind of also plays into the whole kind of financial independence where, you know, you're keeping your expenses really low. And these people, they're building these homes for, you know, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, which in some places in the U.S., that is how much a normal house costs. But in California, I can't get like a closet for that amount of money.
So I won't talk about it.
Yes. Right. you can't even begin to look inside of a place for under $500,000. So when I saw this, I was like, this is a really cool lifestyle. And it made me think, like, well, you know, if you lived in one of these, your expenses could be so low. You know, maybe you could, you know, speed up your retirement plans. And then I love the design of them. They get really creative with the furniture. Stuff's like hidden in the walls. And this pulls out over here and turns into a table. It's so creative and interesting. And so, I just watch all these shows about them. And then when I started the show, I was like, you know, I think really pretty early on, I was like, you know, I would love to do a show on like tiny houses. But I don't know how that's going to happen, but, you know, I kind of kept that in the back of my mind. And then I started following this Instagram account, Dream Big, Live Tiny. And the guy who runs it, Alan, he posts all these different pictures of these tiny homes. And so I talked with him and we did an episode together. And then he posted this tiny home that was in Phoenix, Arizona. And I live in LA. And so I was like, that's not too far from where I live. Maybe one day I'll have a chance to go out there. And I was like, you know, I think it was like a weekend coming up. I had some like travel miles and I was like, hey, you know, let's go to Arizona. And I messaged them and I was like, hey, I'm going to be in the area. I booked this place. I have a show. You know, I would love to talk with you. And they agreed. So we went down there, stayed in this tiny house and I got to interview them about what it was like to, you know, they built this home themselves. Well, they, with the help of some people, they didn't actually, you know, pick up a hammer and build it, but they paid to have this house built. and they rent it out. And it was such a cool experience, and kind of talking with them about what it was like, building it and having the space. And so that kind of that solidified my love of tiny houses. And I can't wait till I get a chance to stay in another one. I don't know if I'll ever have one myself, because California, they don't like people doing stuff that's fun. So they may.
I mean, you could smoke weed.
Well, that's true. Just not inside of a tiny house. You can't build one. You can build one. You can smoke it in a regular house, but not in a tiny house.
So maybe you just answered my question there, because I actually consider myself a minimalist. And shout out to Dr. RDB, because he was talking about tiny homes, like you said, with podcasts, like before anybody was talking about it. He's like, I'm going to get a tiny home. I'm going off the grid. This is going to be the next movement. We're like, you crazy person. Now, he laughs at us every time an article comes out. So shout out to him. That being said, I haven't ran it by Current Bay, but I did run it by, I don't know what to call the last one, but it ain't going to be Bay.
Smart move.
Thank you. I just saved myself there. And basically, she looked at me like it was the nah face. So have you ran this tiny home dream? Like, it's like the
bachelor
pad in the basement. Yeah. Yeah. So what's the overall picture here on the odds?
Well, my wife, she went with me, so she stayed with me at this tiny house.
Okay.
And we both liked it. We really enjoyed it, because she watched the shows with me, and we're always, we'll talk about, I wonder, could we do that? And after being in one, we were only there for one night. It seems like it's possible. You could do it, but you are definitely very close to each other, and there are no rooms in a tiny house. The whole thing is one room. So I could see the limitations of it. My dream would be, I need two tiny houses next to each other. So maybe build like a hallway between two tiny houses. And then I think you can make that work. But then I think you're getting close to just a normal size house at that point. But I could see it. I could see it working. You just got to be creative, because you're going to spend a lot of time outside. Because I think that's what helps, is you have a nice outdoor space. So then, that's like your separation. So, someone could be inside, someone could be outside at different times. And that way you can kind of do your own thing in your own space, but then still come together, to eat a meal or hang out, do things like that.
See, I'm reminded of when everybody tried to beat the cord cutting big pharma cord cutting, and now they're oosquering everybody by charging you for each package. And so somebody's gonna come out with this grandiose disrupting idea to put it all back together and call it cable 2.0. But that being said, so I feel like you're gonna move it to a tiny home that then becomes two tiny homes, that eventually becomes a McMansion, and we're back where we started. But maybe that's a 10 to 15 year journey. That was going to be a question that I had, though, because I'm generally fascinated by this. I don't know if the listeners are, so we can move on after this. But do you have the same property? So, is it a 350, square foot home or whatever the case may be on an acre of land? What's the dynamics?
So what I've seen people do is, there's a bunch of different situations, and I think it really depends on where you live, because different states, different cities have different laws on what you can do, or where you're going to have a property. Like for California, the issue is it's a minimum square footage issue. So a lot of these tiny homes can be as small as 180 square feet. And so for them, they're like, no, that's too small. You can't build. They won't allow you to build a property that small on land. So what a lot of people do is they'll build them on a trailer. And that's their way of getting around it, because you can just park it somewhere, but you probably not on the street, but you have to find some spot where they'll allow you to keep it. And that's a way of getting around the minimum square footage laws. But I've seen some people in other states where they're more lenient. They'll, either buy or rent a piece of land, and then that's where they'll place their tiny home, whether it's on the ground or if it's on a trailer, and that'll be kind of where they live and do their thing. And basically, you have a lot of times they're in a big open space, so they have all this land around them. It's really, spacious. Not like here, where in California, I could probably put my hand out the window and touch my neighbor's place. And it's really appealing, the idea of having, room to, walk outside and not have someone staring at you right away.
Trailer. So when I hear trailer, I imagine a home literally being on the back of a truck. Similar to a truck that might have two cars on it. Is that the type of trailer you mean? That imagery to me is, I'm like, really? So you could just drive your house to work?
You could. I mean, you may not want to. It may not be good for you to keep driving it around, but yeah, you could. They're meant to be able to be moved. So think of a metal frame with wheels on it, basically. Like a flat metal frame that's, has a trailer hitch on it. And that's what they build the house on. So they build it up on this trailer, and they come in all different sizes. I've seen huge ones that are have six tires on it, or a smaller one. It's just a normal two wheel trailer that you hook up to the back of a truck. And yeah, you can move it if you want to. But the one we stayed in, they built it on a trailer, but they had it in their backyard and it was stationary because they actually had it hooked up to plumbing and electricity. So that way, I mean, you could move it, but it would take a lot of work to move that one.
Got it. So you are a married man. I got to ask, how'd y'all meet, fam?
High school, actually. We met in high school. I was a senior, she was a junior, and we were both on the track team. And that's how we ended up meeting. I was out there throwing a discus, a big metal frisbee. I was not running because I do not enjoy running. And she also was doing that. And I think the funny thing was we were both in an Asian American club. We're both black and we were both in the Asian American club for some reason.
That seems really random, but I appreciate the diversity in thought.
Yeah. You know, I was like, my friends come in all colors. So I was like, hey, yeah, I'll come to this club. I'll join you. And we were there, and of course, we were the only two black people there. And then people were like, hey, you two should talk to each other. It's like, why? Because we're the only two black people here? And they're like, yeah, pretty much. So so we kind of didn't know. We kept just seeing each other all over the place. And we ended up just kind of talking, hanging out, and kind of just started from there.
And so how long have you officially been married? And then also, I'm curious, did you go to the same college or go to separate colleges and do the distance thing? So that, and then, what's that married life like?
So we've been married for... it'll be 7 years end of this year. And then, we ended up going to different colleges, but we both were local. So we both, actually, the funny thing is we grew up not that far from each other. I think our parents lived about 10 minutes from each other. We just didn't know. And so we were already kind of in close proximity. And then when I went to school about maybe 20 miles from where I lived. And she was pretty local too, about another maybe like 15, 20 miles. So it was pretty easy. We were both just commuting back and forth to school. And we still lived with our families at the time we were in college. So it didn't really end up being like a long distance thing.
And when you talk to men who are like, yo, what's it like to be married? What do we need to know? What can you tell us without getting yourself in trouble?
That's a very important thing to tackle on the end there. I would say it's definitely different. Like dating is one thing, but being married is a whole other set of circumstances because you really are kind of sharing everything. You're sharing, you know, not only living space and money and time. It's just everything is kind of, it goes together. And I think for me, I think the biggest thing was kind of being considered of the time aspect of it. Because for me, it was like, well, if I want to go do something, I'm just going to go do it. That's just how life works, right? You just go, hey, a friend said they're having a fight party. I'm see you later. I'll be back. And it doesn't necessarily work that way. And I think it's learning to kind of balance and incorporate two lives together, which gets difficult. And I think that's what takes a lot of time and communication because it's not easy. It's definitely something you have to kind of work at and talk about a lot. And it's a lot of difficulties too, but it's communication is the biggest thing, which is what was hard for me because I don't like talking about how I feel, but that's something that you kind of have to do and it's important to do. So that's probably like my biggest thing.
So how did you develop that ability to talk more deeply? Because I know people who are married and they still can't do it. And for me, I couldn't effectively do it even when I was engaged until the point that I was no longer engaged. And then I went and talked to a therapist. So how have you managed to develop that skill?
It's been difficult. And, one funny thing, I don't think I ever told you this, Rich. You talking about therapy on here is one of the reasons why I decided to go ahead and give it a try. Because I was very opposed to it because I was like, that's what crazy people do. I'm not crazy. I don't need to talk to a therapist. It's just all the stigma around it. And kind of hearing you talk about it openly on the show, and my wife had brought it up. We're like, maybe we should give this a try.
We always do.
There's things that, right? It's probably rarely when the guy is the one that brings it up. And it's like one of those things where it's like, maybe this would be a good thing, but I don't want to, tell people that I'm doing this. But when you hear other people talk about it, it kind of normalizes it. And I was like, okay, I'll give this a try. And that has been helpful because there's things that you bring up in like a therapy situation that you would not bring up at all one-on-one. Because one, you don't want to start an argument or it's just difficult. You don't want to talk about it. So I'd say that for sure has been something that helps. And then strangely, doing a podcast forces you to talk and think about, how you're feeling and what's going on. And that has really, I think, helped my communication and my understanding of like, how do I formulate what I want to say and what I'm thinking about? And how do I, you know, and then kind of being accepting of other people's thoughts and feelings and things like that, because when you're talking to a guest, you know, you're hearing them out, you're having to really listen because you have to respond. You can't just have them say something and then just ignore it. You got to be ready to, you know, respond back to them. So that's given me a lot of practice and kind of talking and kind of thinking about what the person's saying and how I feel about it and responding without my normal response would be, I don't want to talk about this right now. Let me think about this. I'll get back to you in a couple of days.
Or like a week, or let me think about it and then just hope it doesn't come up again.
Yeah, that's the ultimate goal, is that they just forget and you don't have to talk about it. But that normally does not work.
Man, that's dope. And I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad you gave it a try. And I hope others out there consider it if it's something that they've never thought about before. But something you said within there sparked a thought for me. And I realized that there are a lot more people who are speaking publicly about therapy and that it's becoming a little bit more normalized. And someone tied this actually to why personal finance is becoming a hotter topic, because more people are talking about it and now it's starting to become normalized. But my question was going to be for you, do you feel that finance was always cool? You know, even because you were interested in the space. And so if someone is interested in finance, yes, they're going to be around other people that maybe want to talk about those topics. But do you feel like it's like there's been this shift to where now this lane is officially cool to be in?
I think in the media, it is definitely getting more attention. Like I'm seeing more and more articles about it and people talking about, you know, what millennials are doing and how much they should save and the debt crisis. And, you know, it's becoming, I think, something you hear more and more. But I think people still really aren't comfortable talking to each other about it, like in real life. And there's still, I think, a lot of stigma around that because it's still really personal. And I think a lot of us feel like we're doing a bad job at it. And you don't want to talk about something you're bad at. And then you get into the whole comparison issues. The funny thing was, I just recently, I was hanging out with some friends and we were at a coffee shop and we were just talking. And then the topic of money came up, like salaries. And then one of my friends, he was like, you know, somebody asked him, like, so how much are you making now? And he was like, I don't really want to talk about it. And I was like, oh, you know, there's no shame talking about it. You know, it's no big deal. And he's like, well, how much do you make then? And I was like, well, we never talked about it. He's like, no, you never said anything about that. And I was like, oh, well, this is how much I make. And he looked at me because he didn't know how much I made. And I was pretty sure I made more than him, but I just, you know, you don't want to, I'm not going to like rub that in or anything. And it got a little awkward and he still never said how much he made. I still don't know how much he makes.
He got you.
But he got me. He tricked me into telling him that he did not reciprocate that action. So there's still, I think there's this issue with not wanting to be doing worse than your friends or people you hang out with. And I think that keeps people, I think, a little quiet when it comes to talking about what's really going on. And I think it's kind of freeing. It's kind of like therapy where, you know, you once you say it out and it becomes normal once you can open up and have a conversation about it. And then I think some of that shame and stigma goes away. But you got to cross that hurdle and you probably should do this with like close friends. I wouldn't do this with someone I don't really know, but with close friends, you know, I think you can get to that point, but you got to be open and willing to have that conversation, which I don't think a lot of people are.
Chris, do you or have you, I guess, either currently or in the past work in the government sector? And there's a reason why I'm asking this question.
Oh, yes, I have.
And I ask that because, and for the, I actually know there's a lot of government sector listeners. I don't know if I bring them all, because some of them are quite literally my coworkers. But it's a weird context or duality for me because, and as you know, my and our income bands have been public record for like, I don't know, 400 years, but definitely all of my career. So anytime, at any point since age 22, if someone literally quite wanted to know what Marcus Garrett made, it was at first Yahoo. It was a Yahoo click away. And then at some point it became a Google click away. Funny side note, Yahoo has been down equal amount of times or more than Facebook. And I have not seen nary a news story about it because no one cares. I still have an email address over there that I try to check. And it's like, this website is down. I'm like, I ain't seen no news story about this. So if y'all are also struggling to address or get to Yahoo, it has been down, but nobody cares. I guess you need to migrate it over to Google, which is probably what I'm going to do. That being said, so that information has been readily available. So do you feel like because of that, perhaps you were either more comfortable having those conversations? I kind of sometimes feel like I'm at a place in these conversations and I've kind of been there for 10 years that people are catching up to.
You know, I think that that's a good point, you know, because it is public information. And then for years, I actually was a payroll manager. So I was over payroll department and I would see people's pay all the time. I knew what everybody made and I knew what they were doing with their money. So, and, you know, it desensitizes you a little bit because before I worked in payroll, I worked at a bank. So I was used to being around a bunch of money and it just becomes paper. You know, you see $100,000 sitting on a counter in 20s and you're just like, you know, who's going to put that away? You don't even think about it anymore. It becomes nothing. And kind of the same thing happens with pay where I would see these people, you know, you see people making all types of pay ranges from the person making, you know, minimum wage and, you know, their checks is, you know, $50 at the end of the pay period. And you see people who are making, you know, $200,000 on the top end. And you have to kind of just like separate yourself from it. And it just becomes normal because people come in and talk to you about it. You have to just act like you don't care and it's no big deal. And it just becomes casual. And I think working in those two environments kind of, I think, has desensitized me a little bit to talking about finance. And then plus, I talk about it all the time now. So I think all those things together have made me, I think, more comfortable than the average person when it comes to talking about money.
Okay, I appreciate that. And I'll share one thing for the listeners and then one funny story. So because of that, I just wrote a recent post and it was pretty revealing. It actually came from a listener question, which I'm pretty sure was a troll, but I entertained it anyway. And so if folks want to check that out, it's over at paychecksandbalances.com/blog. But it's I made my first million and I'm still broke. And you can take a look at that. And I actually charted my income and I cut it off from age 22 to 36. I started working at age 16. I just really kind of did a personal analysis. It was not of my own accord. It actually comes from Your Money or Your Life by Vicki Robin. And she says, you know, like a lot of personal finance writers, where you spend your money is where you truly value. And I feel like a lot of people hadn't done that analysis. And I was like, you know what? I got a platform, heavy lies the crown, you know, more responsibility, more pressure. So I put that out there for the folks to read. But the funny story is the reason I know that my income has been public record for so long, I actually did not know. And then my girlfriend, actually it was an ex-girlfriend, she emailed me one day like, this is how much money you make? And I was like, and she knew.
Whoa, excuse me.
And she knew. And I was like, how did you obtain this information? It was like a random email because I forgot I was talking about something. And I'll go ahead and say at the time, I think I had just started making 70 or it was somewhere around 70,000. I remember she was shocked and appalled and she didn't believe me at first. I was like, yeah, I'm making like 70. And then she like ran out and verified this information. But if you are curious, there's a database out in Texas, I think just to be nosy and petty, but it's run by a very large news organization. I won't drop their names since I just introduced them as large and petty, but it's out there and they track every year and they refresh every public state employee and then they publish it every year. And she had got hold of this information and I don't know how she went down and found my name. I feel some type of way about that. This was several years ago and we're still friends now. I thought it was a little weird, but to your point, I realized that those conversations of that type were like just more normalized. Like you could, if you were into it, you could know what like you said, every coworker, my agency now, there's 57,000 employees. If you want to know that information, it's all public record. And that transparency helps and harms. And it's just so, I wouldn't say funny. It's interesting seeing the discussions that happen in the private sector where these conversations come out where, you know, two coworkers are making such a large discrepancy, or usually it's men and women are making such a large discrepancy. And I'm sitting over here with like the meme shrugged face like, yeah, didn't everybody notice?
Nah, we didn't.
Exactly.
We didn't.
Yeah, it's true because like we all know what each other make and it causes problems when there's somebody who's lazy and then you're like, they make more than me. And right. That's when the issues come up. But it is weird thinking that, you know, in private, no one really knows unless you talk about it and it becomes this big issue.
And that was going to be my question for you. Did you, because I remember in a previous job, which I will not name, I came across what the person in the role before me made and I felt some type of way. And since you knew what everyone made, did you ever have that, man, him, he making more than me?
Oh yeah, all the time. But you gotta suppress that. I remember we hired a new person into the payroll department and I was training them. And every day they would come to me because they sat like right across from me. They're like, they make this much? What? No. I know they were out sick. They didn't put this down. And it was like, they were getting real petty and they were looking at every detail. I was like, you know what? You just got it. Don't worry about it. Just become desensitized. This is just a job. These are numbers and you just got to move on. Nothing you can do about it. So you might as well just get over it because you're going to make yourself real upset.
Yeah. I realized the only thing I can do is negotiate better next time.
Yeah, right.
Yo, I appreciate that, Rich. I mean, for people who want to know, I take an ignorance is bliss approach. I don't look up nothing. People tell me all the time, but I don't look up nothing. Because, like, I know myself well enough to know that I am petty adjacent. Like, I'm petty Pendergrass if I know the information, and I'll sing. But I don't go out there and try to find information out. Then if they tell me, I'd be like, God, you know, now I got to do something about it, because that's just what my nature is. But to Rich's point, and I don't struggle with this as much, although now I'm getting back into the hiring manager role. That's difficult to be on the other side of the table. So I strongly encourage people to, yes, if it is available, it's a little bit more difficult in public. It's probably more amenable in private. But yes, to always negotiate your salary. I remember quickly that I was at a bar just having a conversation with somebody who's about to go in for an interview. She was asking my advice. And this like drunk recruiter was like, we always have 20% extra. And if you don't take the 20%, I take it home. So I never tell you anything. I was like, thank you for this scandalous information. drunk payroll recruiter person. So yes, if you have the ability, and I don't like to put percentages to it, but I feel like 5 to 10% is safe from the amount that they come back with you. And I end that story with, I've never turned anyone down for just asking, is this a firm offer? Because sometimes the answer is yes. But if the answer is no, then yeah, come back with what your reasonable salary should be.
Yeah, I've never seen an offer pulled because someone asked for more money or additional benefits. I think where it becomes an issue, and I've said this on the show before, is when someone says, if you can get me X, I'm ready to sign the offer. And then you get them X and they're like, but no, wait, I actually want more now. And it's like, yo, you just said, yeah, if we do X, then you'll be ready to move forward. Now you're playing games. Now we're questioning your character. Now we're not moving forward. And it's not because you asked for more. It's because you essentially gave your word and now you're reneging on it. And that could be symptomatic of a much bigger issue with you. So thanks. Goodbye. So I do think that there's that situation. And also, I did want to say, not every recruiter keeps that extra 20%. I know that I wish that were the case, because over the years, particularly working in-house, and so there's the difference between being a recruiter internally at a company versus being a headhunter at a staffing agency, where yes, you are trying to get that fee, and there are situations where you are trying to get someone to take less so you can make more. And so I suspect the drunkard that you encountered was more in that latter category.
He seemed knowledgeable, just intoxicated.
So, Chris, I know I mentioned along the way that you have a debt stories, but right before that, how did the conversations around money go between you and your wife? And then can you tell us the debt story and how y'all found your way out of it?
You know, I don't think we really had much of a like money conversation or money talk before we got married or before we got into debt. I'm trying to think back. It's been a while now, so I'm trying to think, but I don't remember too many conversations. It was more so like, you know, we're getting up to the wedding. It was like, you know, how much should we be spending? Or hey, maybe can we cut back here? We had like those type of conversations, but not a whole lot about, you know, what our money situation was and things like that, because I didn't have any debt going into the marriage. I'd had a little bit of debt before, and then I managed to pay that off. And so when we got leading up before the wedding started, you know, costing money, didn't have any debt. But then when it was time to actually pay for stuff, we didn't have really any money saved up. I had saved up some money, but that money went towards the engagement ring. And then after that, it was pretty much, what are we going to do? And we were like, well, I guess we'll put this on a credit card, which was, you know, hindsight now, a horrible idea.
Here we go.
By the time, right? At the time, it seemed like, well, you know, we're going to try to keep this reasonable. And, you know, we have to do this. And, you know, we're going to, you know, keep it under control. But when it was all said and done, I think we ended up spending between the wedding and the honeymoon, I think it was somewhere around, I think like $14,000-$15,000. And all that went on multiple credit cards. And, you know, our family, they helped as much as they could, but they really weren't in a position to help us too much financially. And so we paid for the wedding. Then we needed a place. So we didn't live together prior to getting married. And so I was living with a roommate, and I'm a guy, I didn't have any furniture. I had like a bed and a couch. I think that's all the furniture I own. and so I was like, well, I guess we need furniture. So we took a trip down to IKEA, and I don't know, I think we spent probably like $1,800, which I was like, well, I guess that's not horrible.
No, it's not bad.
It's not too bad. And then we were like, okay, we got this situated. Then it was, oh, well, some school costs came up for my wife. I think they pulled like some financial aid that she was going to get, and we had to come up with the money. Then there was like a couple of doctor's bills that came up. I think it was like an emergency room visit that was like $1,000. All these things just started kind of ticking up. And then on top of that, we weren't really talking about money. And so we didn't really have a budget, and we were kind of just both spending money, not really talking to each other, not really having a plan. And so we'd end up running out of money, and then we would end up pulling out the credit card to cover, you know, the last few days until the next payday. Mm. And all these things just kind of built and built and built. And so we got married in 2012, and I believe it was end of 2014 when I decided maybe I should kind of add all this up and kind of see what's going on. Like, I hadn't really looked. I knew we were racking up debt. I knew it was sitting there still, but I didn't know what it was. And when I added it up, it was just over $27,000. And I was like, I can't believe this happened. Like, what was going on? Mm. And it was like one of the most, I think, like stressful times of my life. It kind of consumes you when you see this number that's so huge. And I think at the time, I think my salary was maybe $40,000 at the time. And so I'm like, we almost have as much debt as I make in an entire year. And it was rough, and it kind of changed everything I did going forward. And my focus was on how can I make more money? And one good thing that came from being in debt was it really motivated me to kind of progress in my career and look for opportunities to promote and not settle in any one place. I think I would move like every 2 to 3 years. I would find a new job or look for promotions, things like that, to kind of help my salary keep growing and not stick where I was at. But once we got to that point where we knew how much debt we had, that's when we had to really sit down and talk. And what I noticed, which I didn't really think about, was my background is in finance, and I kind of, you know, my job was in finance. I think I thought about money more, and it was more of a big deal to me because it was something I was thinking about all the time. But for my wife, she, you know, she works with kids. Money's not really something that she talks about. It didn't hit her as hard because it wasn't it's real. Because it wasn't something that was on her radar as much. And that's something that came out through us talking about it. And I would talk about my stress levels and how it was affecting me. And I think that's what kind of got us into the routine of talking. And she really let me kind of take the lead and shape our budget and our finances, because I think I was able to express how important this was and how much of a negative impact this was having on my mental health and my life overall.
Did you find yourself having the internal crisis of, I can't believe I'm in this situation. I freaking work in finance. Like, how is this happening to me?
Oh, yeah. And that makes you not want to talk about it even more. You're like, I really don't want anyone to know what I've done because I'm supposed to be educated. I went to school and studied this, and I didn't follow anything that I learned or any of the advice. And it created shame. I don't know if I would say more shame than anyone else, but it created a high level of shame for myself. And I didn't talk to anyone about it. I don't think I told a friend about it until we were like on like maybe like the last maybe 6 months of paying off the debt, because it was like, you know, I don't want people to think that I don't know what I'm doing, or that I'm dumb, or that I, you know, so irresponsible and can't handle my own stuff. And I really wish I would have talked to someone, because it would have taking so much of the stress off and giving me, it's kind of like a release valve to kind of open it up and talk about your finances, talk about the struggles you're having, instead of kind of keeping it bottled up and internalized, because I know I kind of beat myself up and really kind of sit and get really like upset about it and then really stressed, and it just overwhelms you. And I really wish I wouldn't have let myself get to that point and kind of just said, hey, you know what? I need to talk to somebody, anybody, and just so I can, you know, say it out loud and then kind of get it off my chest.
Yeah. Not be beating up pillows in solitude. While your wife's at work. That's real though, man. So how did you all start to knock that debt off?
The biggest thing was really kind of, and it's like the most boring thing in the world is to say, you know, make a budget. But really that's what it was. It's every month we were spending more money than we made. It would just happen every month. And we had no game plan on what we were doing and how much we should be spending on different things. And really it was just like a kind of like a trial and error thing. I was like, okay, I know we need to get this under control. We have to have a dedicated amount that we're sending towards debt. So what I did was I just pulled out an Excel spreadsheet and wrote down, okay, this is how much money we bring in. This is a list of our expenses, and let's see what can we cut, what can we do to make a little more room. And so it started off by just saying, okay, what is our bare necessities? What's the cost for rent, food, gas, health insurance, so the necessities that we had to pay, and then everything else we're going to put towards debt. And we went like super lean. We basically were like, you know, hey, we'll keep $20 a month to maybe go out to eat once somewhere very inexpensive and go from there. And then as I made more money, as I progressed in my career, I was able to put more and more money towards the debt and kind of just bump that up. And I would try really hard to take any money that I would make in a raise and put that towards debt. I fought the urge to keep it as much as I wanted to keep it and spend it. And I would, put that towards debt. And there were setbacks. There were times where I definitely would kind of go crazy. You get burnt out and you end up splurging on something. But I'd always try to bring my, it happens. You know, I would try to bring myself back in line after I got whatever it was that I shouldn't have bought and get back on track.
And how long did it take y'all to pay that debt off overall once you saw that 27K number from there to the time that it was officially gone?
It took us about 2.5 years to pay it all off.
That's not bad.
So I felt like it was like a reasonable amount of time because we had setbacks for sure. There were times where we'd have, a lot of it was like health insurance things because health insurance isn't what I thought it would be and it didn't cover as much as I thought it should. And so there was a lot of times where I would get a surprise bill in the mail for several hundred dollars for something I thought was just routine. And it would set me back. It would kind of have to pause paying off debt to go ahead and take care of these new bills that came in. So there was definitely some back and forth. But overall, 2.5 years to get all that taken care of.
Congratulations, man. And I've said on the podcast that hearing that story and thinking about how having your money tied up in debt stops you from doing everything, well, not everything, stops you from doing many things. It was a big factor in me paying off my car note 2 years early. I'm like, I could really be using this money for something else. And I know there's varying views about whether or not that's worth it. But for me, not having any type of debt hanging over my head was like that freed up a lot of mental real estate in addition to freeing up the cash. So I'm sure you probably felt similar.
Yeah, it's amazing how freeing it is. Like you can't even imagine it. Like I remember when it actually happened, when I made that last payment and it's like, oh, I don't have to send this money anymore. I can keep my money that I'm working for. It's a great feeling. It's something that I'll never forget how that felt doing that.
So we're rounding toward the end of the show and it's been dope having you on. And I do have a question that if I did not ask it, I would be I might actually be beating up a pillow. And I'm not sure if I would call it a deep question, but I'd love to get your thoughts on it. So I've really been waiting to have a black male personal finance podcast host on the show because, I mean, let's be honest, there's not really many of us out there. And so my question was going to be, have you noticed the same thing? And I think I know your answer to that. And why do you think that is? Because when I look around and I look at people of color in the space, and there are a lot of men of color who are in the personal finance space, but not necessarily in the podcast space specifically. So why do you think that is?
That is a deep question. And yeah, you're right. There are not a lot of black male podcasters, especially in the finance space. And I really in any space, I listen to a lot of podcasts and I finally found a technology podcast hosted by a group of three black men. It's called the SMR podcast. And I was like, I can't believe it's a mixture of tech and have people look like me hosting it. So I was like, I got to subscribe to this. And so I don't know what it is. I think it's just like an exposure thing. Because when I talk to my friends, I have friends of all different backgrounds. What I typically see is that I don't hear a lot of podcast talk in general with my friends who are black. And I don't know what it is. I really don't have a good answer for why we don't see more people who look like us in the space. Maybe it's just an exposure thing. And maybe something similar to like, when you talk about personal finance and money, you have to kind of be exposed to it to maybe think of that something, a path that I could see myself in or something I could see myself taking on. And I don't know if that's what it is on the podcasting side, but yeah, it definitely is. There's a discrepancy because I think the majority of podcast hosts in general are white men, I think overwhelmingly. Mm-hmm. And then, you just kind of trickle down to all the other demographics. But I'm not quite sure why that is. I don't know. What has your experience been with that?
I definitely notice it. And we were on another podcast recently and I was thinking about it and I could not think of another personal finance show that was hosted by two black men. And I thought of you, but like, that was it. that was like the only one. And I'm sorry if there's some other show that I'm not thinking of, you matter. But in the context of that conversation, I couldn't think of anyone else. And so I definitely think that there's an exposure element, particularly around podcasting still, for as popular as it's becoming, there's still a lot of people who don't understand it, don't know what it is, have never listened to a podcast before. So I definitely think that that's a factor in it. And Marcus and I, we've also talked about even the ways that men talk about and relate to money are there less of us in this space because, you know, we feel even less comfortable talking about this particular topic versus some of the other things where other folks who these conversations may have been more normalized, whether when they were growing up or during their adult years, they feel more comfortable having these types of conversations. So, for example, I see a lot more women of color in this space, you know, so what makes that different? And I would probably have to ask an actual woman of color podcaster on an upcoming show, like why is there more representation on that side in the space, even though the representation overall is still not great? But to me, it seemed like there's something specific to men. And I think the exposure is part of it. I think there's some ego that's part of it, some pride that's part of it, and some other things that I can't quite put my fingers on.
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense for sure. And it is great seeing all the women of color who are, you know, in this space. And I always love seeing, you know, the representation there. And maybe it is because I know in my household, my mom was the one who handled the finances. And so maybe that is a common thing, is that in a lot of households, even which is kind of weird because there's a discrepancy in pay with women who are paid less and, you know, they're not compensated on a fair level. But at the same time, a lot of them are expected to maintain the finances of the home and manage in some situations. And so maybe that kind of just trickles down where maybe, I don't know, maybe guys who are in these situations don't have the interest in managing it. They just want to make money and they don't think they have to pay attention to it, and they'll have somebody else do it for them. And maybe that's where something that comes from. I don't know.
I definitely appreciate that perspective. And even the idea of, you know, women managing money in the home, that was something I had not considered previously before in this conversation. So I'm glad I did ask you the question. And I'm glad that we were finally able to return the favor and have you on the podcast, because it's definitely been awesome. A lot of insight, a lot of nuggets. Learn things about you like I thought that I would. I did not know that you were a discus man. We'll have to talk about that separately. I was a long jumper, so I did have to run a bit. But tell the people where they can find you on the web and find more out about the podcast.
Oh, yeah. So you can find me just by going to popcornfinance.com, and you can find Popcorn Finance Podcast anywhere you find podcasts. You know, if where you're listening to this great Paychecks and Balances show here, you just go to the same place. You can find Popcorn Finance there or on any of the social media places. Just look for Popcorn Finance. You'll find me on there.
Dope, man. Appreciate you coming on.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for having me. I'm really, really excited I got the chance to join you guys.
Man, that was such a good conversation with Chris. In some ways, good brother, I think it represented everything that we want P&B to be.
Yeah, I feel like that's our second high school sweetheart guest, if I remember correctly.
Second or third, I think Ty and Talit from His and Her Money. I think they were high school, then some stuff happened, and then they... Anyway, yes, it's one of the top three, or one of the only three. One of those.
Hey, man, you know, out here rooting for black love, that's all I'm saying.
Yo, so I did find it funny that part of how they met was being recommended that they talk to each other as being part of the Asian American Society or Asian American Club. That was so freaking random to me.
You know, I hate when that's right. I guess hate's the wrong word. Yeah, have you ever heard somebody, they're like, hey, do you know that other black guy? And it's like literally only one other black guy. And you do? I don't know what's worse.
Yeah, but thanks again to Chris for coming on the podcast. And if you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to share with your network, subscribe, and hit us with those 5 stars in Apple Podcasts, and say a few words about the show. Today's review of the week comes from LaRuski Love.
I'm feeling the name. I heard you, Rich. 5 stars. 5 stars for the Matt Foley callback. Snuck it in. Much can be learned in a van down by the river. Thumbs up emoji.
So if you're new to the podcast or you didn't check out a few episodes back, so, and I forget what I was talking about. I think I was talking about one of my previous jobs where that's what I was doing. I was talking about a previous job where I did drive a van, and I actually did drive a van down by the river. So this listener picked up on that. Appreciate you catching that reference. I realized making that reference now that I probably did date myself a bit, because that was how many years ago? Was that like over 20 years ago, man?
It is, yeah, I want to say 2025, because somebody just posted an SNL, like, top 5 in Chris Farley's dance-off with the Fabio-looking guy, but not Fabio, I forget what his name is, was, like, in the top 5, where they were at Chippendales. And if y'all don't know this reference, then you're too young, buddy.
So, LaRuski Love, appreciate those 5 stars.
And if you'd like to find us on social, we're on Twitter and Instagram at PayBalances and Facebook at Paychecks and Balances, where you can catch more of these outdated references. Follow our individual accounts at the Marcus Garrett with one T on Twitter, two T's everywhere else on earth, because that's my government name. Rich is all over the internet at I Am Rich Jones.
I sure as hell am.
And as we mentioned up top, don't forget to join the email list by visiting paybal.co/email. You'll receive our weekly newsletter, first dibs on the upcoming course, interesting reads, actionable tips, and much more.
So thanks to everyone for listening. And until next time, be safe. We out. Peace.